What will a united Korea look like? I'm not just asking what kind of government will administer the peninsula, whether it will be a federal or a centralized one, but rather how people from either side of the demilitarized zone today will view and interact with one another tomorrow. Will they really see each other as one people? The Korean language, while understandable to one another, has diverged significantly in the two countries. And the two people's sense of shared history is certainly shaped by the rival governments in Seoul and Pyongyang that tell divergent narratives. We're still far away from unification, but these are issues that are going to require deep consideration, and it's one that needs to happen ahead of time so that both Koreas can prepare for the integration of the people in one nation. The question of identity is precisely the subject that our two guests today will discuss on Korean Context. Through interviews and surveys of defector migrants from North Korea living in South Korea, and comparing them to responses from South Koreans, our guests' research suggests that significant shifts are underway in how Koreans, especially younger Koreans, view their national identity. With no further ado, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Stephen Denny is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto focusing on identity, attitudes, and behaviors in post-autocratic and transitional societies, with a particular emphasis on Korea. Christopher Green is a PhD candidate at Leiden University. His research covers a wide range of topics in the Korean Peninsula, including political economy, ideology, the media landscape, and other issues impacted by the division of the Korean Peninsula. He is also the senior advisor for the Korean Peninsula at the International Crisis Group. They're also both senior editors of the fantastic research blog SinoNK, which you can find at sinonk.com. Thank you both for coming on Korean Context. You've just written a paper for the Korea Economic Institute on how North Korean defectors living in South Korea view themselves and their new adopted country. Naturally, the scope of the research carries implications for how the two Koreas may be shaped if and when reunification takes place. Chris Green, if I may start with you, we tend to imagine North Korean defectors as peoples leaving Korea for economic reasons, particularly since the famine of the 1990s. But the paper highlights that there have been different waves of North Korean defectors motivated by different circumstances and using different paths. Would you talk a little about these different groups of defector migrants to South Korea?
Sure. So if we look at the headline numbers, there's about 31,000 North Korean defector migrants in South Korea today, and there are, of course, many more elsewhere. If we drill down into that community, though, we find six major groups of defector migrants. There's those who made the decision to go north or south in the period between 1945 and 1950, the beginning of the Korean War. There's the very large group that fled the fighting, north or south, during the Korean War. Then there's a very prolonged period of time with relatively limited migration after the hardening of the inter-Korean border. The only people who really moved from north to south or south to north during that period were for particularly unique reasons. And then from 1993 or so, we have three further groups. There are those who escaped in 1993 through to about 1997 or 1998, who we could classify as famine migrants of one sort or another. And then there are two groups characterized by or distinguished by their socioeconomic status in North Korea. The more recent a migrant is, the more likely they are to come from a middle-class background or to have some other reason than existential economic distress for their decision to defect. And then there's also a very large group of people who, the majority of whom would define themselves as chain migrants. So people who came to South Korea from North Korea based upon information they received from people already in South Korea, so family or friends. This is an interesting group because their understanding of the reality of South Korean life is so much better than the aggregate among other groups. So we can divide the defector migrant community into these roughly six groups.
Perhaps you could also very quickly talk about how the South Korean government and the public at large views the North Korean defector community in South Korea.
How the South Korean government views the defector community is a different question to how the South Korean government treats the defector community. the views of the South Korean government have changed over time, and they are also beholden to the political polarization that is endemic in South Korean political culture. The governments of the right have tended to treat elite defectors better than governments of the left. Governments of the left have tended to treat the median defector migrant better than governments of the right. So the way that they view them and the way that they treat them is slightly different. We can also view differences in the government policy mix for dealing with this incoming group of defector migrants, which is related to the numbers of people involved. Certainly, at times between 1993 and the mid-2000s, there were changes in the law which allowed for the median migrant incoming from North Korea to receive more government assistance than had previously been the case. There was a peak in the early 2000s, since when amounts of government assistance have been scaled back somewhat, as the government has become aware of distortions fostered in the community by the extent of government support and the way that government support is delivered. For example, if you give lump sum payments of resettlement assistance to incoming migrants, you will nudge them towards different forms of behavior than if you give incremental payments over a significant period of time. These kinds of things have impact on chain defection, the capacity for family to fund the defection of further members of the family, things like this.
Stephen, the survey that you and Chris investigated finds that South Koreans and resettled North Korean defectors don't actually differ too much in their feelings of loyalty to South Korea. Is that a fair summary of your findings? And were you surprised by some of the conclusions that you found from the survey?
That's an accurate summary of one of the findings, indeed, that on measures of national identity, such as pride in the achievements of the Republic of Korea, there is no divergence in opinion between our sample and that of the South Korean population in 2015. However, if you break this down at different levels of aggregation, you do see some notable variation. And while we don't explain it in the paper, if you look at that on the South Korean side, how they feel about the Republic of Korea and how they feel about the North Korean defector migrants themselves is also very different. Those who are older are much more likely to identify with the defector migrant group along ethno-cultural terms, to see them as co-ethnics and thus as members, integral members of the national community. Younger folks are much less likely to see them in such a way. Also, with regards to their national identity, which you could say that their opinion of the defector migrant group is in some ways a measure of their national identity, because if the co-ethnic aspect of this shared identity is important, then that's reflective of an identity which spans the entire Korean Peninsula.
What do you see as the biggest variable that separates the attitudes of defector migrants towards South Korea and its people?
The most important factor, as we found in our analysis of the data that we collected, is cohort experiences or cohort effects. So grouping defector migrants by age ranges. The paper we published, it's 18 to 34, 35 to 54, and 55 plus. What we find is that those who belong to the age cohort 55 plus think very differently from those who are in the age group 19 to 34 and 35 to 54. Those who are 55 plus are more likely to belong to the Kim Il-sung generation, or if not that, they have spent the entirety of their post-adolescent formative years in North Korea. Further to that, once they resettle in South Korea, at the age they're at, the expectations of their integration in society are very different. Most of them who we've interacted with at an interview basis and have observed in our quasi-ethnographic component of our research, we find that their expectations for integration are much less. They tend to belong to relatively tight-knit communities. They are supported by working siblings who perhaps defected as part of a family chain defection, and they receive some financial support from the government in the forms of welfare provisions. And their existence is relatively simple, stable, and compared to North Korea, well-to-do. We find in our data that their attitudes are reflective of those objective conditions in South Korea, whereas younger folks are expected to go back to school, rebuild social capital, build new social networks, and compete in a highly competitive labor market. For them, they, as a consequence, more likely to feel discriminated against or to struggle in such a way that they would hold a less positive opinion about South Korea, would feel more distant from the Korean national community due to this discrimination or these difficulties in resettling. And indeed, that would more closely align with, I think, a well-known narrative in media stories on defectors, that is their struggle to integrate. What we find is that's indeed true, but for a certain cohort of those who have resettled, it's different. Not that it's untrue. They have their struggles. Certainly, this is a vulnerable migrant group resettling into a society that is quite competitive. It has a welfare system that, while better developed for these groups, isn't exactly as caring as perhaps they might expect or want. And so they do have hardships, but they're far less than those who are younger than them.
And one of the things that you mentioned anecdotally was how closely the North Korean defector migrant community lives with one another actually also has an impact. If you could speak to that a little bit.
Because the government is assigning accommodation to incoming migrants, the young and the old tend to live in some specific areas of cities, specifically Seoul. But the older cohorts live a life that is communally together with other defector migrants, whereas the young people, because of their struggles Stephen just outlined, the things they have to get done in order to succeed in South Korean society, live a more atomized existence, which of course has an impact on their perception of the resettlement experience. Stephen mentioned moments ago the cohorts into which this research divides the survey sample. For the purposes of comparison with South Korea, it's important to have the cohorts divided that way, but it is to an extent arbitrary. And my own research, which is related to this, which deals with just the North Koreans without any need to compare to South Koreans, divides the generation experience into political generations. So there's the Kim Il-sung generation, roughly speaking, 1945 through to 1980. Then there is the Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il joint leadership generation, which runs through to the beginning of the famine. And then there's what we famously hear called the Jangmadang generation, of those who came of age in a period where government provision in North Korea declined and private provision concomitantly increased. And the differences between the experiences of those generations is also very interesting in itself.
Indeed, to follow up on that, other ways that we've looked at this data is grouping those who spent their formative years in North Korea, as I alluded to previously, and those who did not. So a simple binary, 1L0. And what you find for an item like the ethno-cultural one, those who came of age in North Korea are much more likely to think the ethno-cultural component or traits are important. This is reflective of, I think, an internalization of a certain autocratic state discourse that promotes an ethnic nationalism that is very, very difficult to maintain in a democracy. So then you would expect then that those who spent their formative years, in our cases is defined up until 25 years of age in North Korea, that the ethnocultural traits are much more important, whereas those who did not, they are less important. Further, as is indicated in the paper, the ethnocultural traits for those who have spent more than the median number of years in South Korea is lower. In other words, there's an effect due to exposure to South Korea. Is this an internalization of a discourse that is more popular in a democracy, which preaches equality of a different sort than a socialist autocratic country does? Or is it a function of the migration resettlement experience where they find that these ethnic traits or being a co-ethnic of South Koreans isn't sufficient to being considered an integral member of society? Linking that back to the changing attitudes of the South Korean population, whereby the younger people who are less likely to think of them as a co-member of the national community and more likely to think of them as something slightly less than that, perhaps not on par with an immigrant, but not a full-fledged South Korean citizen. So there's a number of things going on here, which are different ways to capture variation within the sample that both Chris and I have looked at. But we looked at the age cohorts because we think it captures both the experiences in North Korea and South Korea, because this is the age variable after all, and it's travels, right? It's not specific to something in North Korea or to something in South Korea. That is, formative years in North Korea, exposure in South Korea, age travels. And what you see is if you divide it in this way, you still see these effects. And it also opens it up to the most creative interpretations, which are consistent with other sorts of data that we work with, qualitative data.
It's interesting that this research is coming out now. There has been a, I think it's fair to say, a humbling reevaluation of a certain type of linear discourse on nationalism that evolved in the sort of end of history period at the end of the Cold War, wherein you go from having an ethno-nationalist form of nationalism to some kind of inclusive civic form of nationalism. This is a linear progression. Now, with these cultural touchstones, the election of President Trump, Brexit in the UK, certain types of ethnic angst in Europe as well. So there has been a reckoning with this much too simplistic vision of how nationalisms evolve over time that this research speaks to. Once you bring in the Korean Peninsula from the cold and stop treating East Asia as a place of uniquely ethno-nationalist sentiment, you can have a discussion surrounding this research, which is in fact applicable across a larger range of locations than you might imagine.
And our contribution to this broader conversation is important yet kind of boring. I'll explain what I mean. So taking into a totality of the data that we work with and findings that we've come across in our data analysis, we see that ethnic nationalism is probably on the decline in South Korea. But you do not have a concomitant rise of this inclusive, embracing civic nationalism that is often praised and talked about as something unique to the democratic, developed West. So you have a decline in ethnic nationalism, but not an uptick in something like a civic nationalism. You just have coethnicity as not sufficient for binding a people together. There are other things at play here. So it is a corrective to this linear, as Chris put it, interpretation of the development of nationalism and national identity.
This is quite interesting, and especially because you brought up the comparison to Western Europe. It seems like there's an inverted process going on in South Korea, where in the West and perhaps in the United States, we have a search for this base or ethno-cultural identity. And it seems like in South Korea, for decades, I think it was presumed that unification will just happen one day because both people are exactly the same. But it seems like the survey suggests that because of the changes in people's perceptions, that might not necessarily be a political inevitability. You mentioned that South Korea doesn't have a rising tide of a new civic identity forming around the ethno-cultural identity mm-hmm. that exists currently. Based on your field research, is there any nascent signs of any other forms of identity that you feel might actually rise one day to fill that gap?
This is a question really about South Korea, South Koreans. It's an increasingly important question, one that's being asked more regularly, and that's being reflected in this more recent identity surveys, which include a greater number of multiculturalism-related questions about different groups in society, about what kind of country people want going forward. And what you see is further evidence that the support for an ethnically homogenous country is on the decline. But it is not necessarily being replaced for support for a multicultural one. What you have instead is a slightly ambiguous national identity. Others interested in similar questions to us have found that the national identity for younger South Koreans is based upon status more than it would be on something like ethnicity, as it might have been for their grandparents.
There's a significant disconnect between the way East Asia is experienced the last 20 years and the way it's been experienced in the developed West. And I suspect that there is an awful lot of connection between the development and evolution of South Korean nationalism and the way that country has experienced this period. There are many things that I could throw out there that I think are salient to this discussion. Because of the way China responded to the 2008 financial crisis, South Korea did not suffer as much as some other countries, for example. South Korea has had a creed of economic development that has largely sustained it through a significant period of time. And you continue to get 3% growth in South Korea's economy, which a lot of countries in Europe would give their eye teeth for. You don't have massive industrial decline, which might lead to the kind of angst in the local population that could prompt a sort of a populist response. And also, at the same time, you have an immigrant population, which is a very, very small percentage of the national population still, when you compare it to some places in Europe or to the United States and Canada. So there are so many socioeconomic aspects that are very different that it's very hard to necessarily compare with European and North American experiences.
And I would like to paint a picture of a future South Korean national identity that's rather optimistic, because I think South Korea has shown its ability to adapt rather quickly to the change in both, you know, its own objective economic circumstances and the geopolitical circumstances surrounding it. I think South Koreans at this period right now show that there is still some support for more than just rapprochement with North Korea, that a vision of a united peninsula, and probably not just because it might be an economic bonanza, so to speak, but because I think there's a genuine feeling of affinity with the people of North Korea, that they are indeed members of a Korean nation. You can have that feeling without being like an ardent, autocratic era-like ethno-nationalist. You can both support an increasingly pluralistic South Korean society, perhaps one with a greater number of immigrants, but also support the integration of co-ethnics. And maybe you're going to favor the co-ethnics over the others, and indeed the data suggests that that is so. But it's not necessarily a reversion back to an ethnically homogenous country. So I think South Korea is the really interesting and fascinating nexus of a number of social forces at play. Chris says, rightly, that the number of immigrants in South Korean population is smaller than, say, the United States or Canada, and that's certainly true, but the increase has been notable since 1999 and slightly before that, when you effectively had no immigrants of note, and now it's roughly 4% of the population is expecting to continue to increase. So you've had a notable increase. Going from 2% to about 4% is quite a lot. There hasn't been a populist authoritarian backlash to this, or it hasn't been exploited necessarily for political gain. Now, the incident or the response to the landing of Yemeni refugees and asylum seekers on Jeju Island is not encouraging, but I think we should also disaggregate opinions towards a more immigrant-based society where people are screened and enter upon their ability to contribute to the economic well-being and future of the country and asylum seekers. I think ideally, as people interested in a fair, just, and safe world, we would like a great solution to the refugee crisis, but we also need to understand that there are certain national angsts that come with the sudden influx of others who are quite culturally different. I think South Korea is dealing with these changes quite incrementally. The number of changes that have been made to the Nationality Act since the late 90s is reflective of South Korea's willingness to adopt what we might consider international standards of a more fair, equitable, and inclusive society. The fact that the Constitutional Court in the early 2000s ruled that jusanguis is not a standard consistent with international standards for citizenship is an indication, I think, or perhaps arguably, if I can be a bit bombastic, a death knell to ethnic nationalism in South Korea. Others would see it differently, but I have a rather optimistic view of how these things are developing.
And that's it from our show today. Just as a quick footnote, because I wasn't familiar with the term, jusanguis, which Stephen mentioned in the context of the South Korean courts not considering it a standard consistent with international norms for determining citizenship, means law of blood, which determines citizenship by who your parents are. This contrasts with jusoli, which is the principle of determining citizenship based on your place of birth. I would like to thank my guests, Chris Green and Stephen Denny, for the invigorating conversation, and to you for listening to Korean Context. You can find the link to Chris and Stephen's new research paper in the description to this podcast episode, or at the Korea Economic Institute website under 2018 Academic Paper Series. You can also read their analysis of the developments on the Korean Peninsula at the research site SinoNK at sinonk.com. You can also catch them frequently contributing analysis and insights on ongoing developments in the Koreas for the Canadian Broadcasting News or The Guardian and elsewhere. If you have any comments or questions, send us a tweet at KoreaEconist. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page, where you can stream our events live and tune in for Korea This Week every Monday at 2 p.m. when we review the most important developments on the peninsula. See you there!